Accession number 17747, reel 19.
I think we were discussing the question of headgear, and you said that the Brigadier wore a tin hat if he was setting a good example when he went forward. Did you wear a tin hat?
Not often, no. It's usually either the peaked cap or forage cap. I don't remember wearing a tin hat at all. Although I dare say I must have done sometimes, but not as a rule. No. We were talking about the Volturno and the Cross the Volturno. For the first time, I remember really nerve-wracking dive bombing. Germans, I said, well, the Germans seem to be using Mustangs, but surely they can't have been. But they were dive bombing. And we heard that the 8th Army, for the first time, were having really hard going on a river called the Trigno, T-R-I-G-N-O. I've noted that I was writing to a girlfriend at home, and I've noted that we are now allowed to describe battle. That's an interesting development, because one had been supposed not to say anything about action at all. I don't think this means that we describe our positions in the current battle, but we were allowed to talk generally about the experience.
You could give impressions.
Yes, that's right. I've noted that some new officers arrive in the regiment. We had had losses in the previous 3 months. And I saw the sort of bureaucracy going on through the war of notices of vacancies and things. I saw the details of a survey course for subalterns, and I put, I don't suppose I have any chance in the circumstances, meaning that I had no chance of being released to do it.
But this would have been in accordance with your earlier interest, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would. I was quite interested when I heard about this. But I was quite right in assuming there was no question of being allowed to do it. And I put, our attack goes in across the valley. Now, I haven't named the valley.
Presumably this is north of the Volturno.
This is north of the Volturno. This is going towards the Garigliano.
Yes.
And the Garigliano was running sort of right to left across to the sea. But also, of course, we've got these mountains up ahead. Our attack goes in across the valley. We're very busy, and the second in command and I stay up all night. We were, in some senses, a partnership in the same way as the adjutant and the colonel.
Yes. So what would you and the 2IC be doing then?
Oh, well, we'd be keeping the night watch.
Ah. So you'd effectively be on call?
We were on sitting by the telephones and receiving information, giving orders for firing plans or whatever, yes.
So you'd be the night shift and the colonel and adjutant would effectively be the day shift?
In this, at this time, yes.
And they would be getting their rest?
That's right. One of the things I noticed about colonels, which I think is very sensible, is that however much sleep deprivation, and there's quite a bit of that later in my notes, however much sleep deprivation we had to face, they tended to try to get a good night's sleep themselves. I don't think any of us resented this, because we knew that they were responsible and they really had to be fresh. Although sometimes it seemed a bit unfair when we were getting half a night and they were getting a night. Sleep became a most valuable, precious commodity.
I mean, did the colonel have a policy about getting sleep for his officers and gunners, or not aware of him having
this view? Was not formalised at that time. In the Anzio bridgehead later, it was very formalised that we were allowed to sleep every second night. He slept every night.
But he was older than you as well.
Not much. It wasn't older than all of us. I mean, he was older than me. But
this was not
we're talking. No, it's not the same one.
Not Colonel McCracken.
No, this was a different one, which we'll come to. I had other colonels, I had four altogether.
So when you were doing this attack across the valley on the way up to the Garigliano, was it still McCracken at that stage?
Oh, yes. Mm. Yes. Shall I lead on and explain how long it was McCracken? We're up to virtually the end of October. Very busy time. I had a terrible motorbike trip on a diverted route to collect a fire plan, presumably from the CRA. Mm-hmm. Back just in time to put it into action. This was 29th of October. 30th of October, my colleague in RHQ, who was working directly as ADC to the colonel, either under that name or a similar name, had his foot blown off by a landmine this morning. I heard the frightful explosion myself and saw him being stretchered away. I feared the worst for myself, but we had another busy day and the attack was going well. Hear rumours, usually wrong, that 56th Division will be allowed to have a rest when the objective is reached. Rotten about Yeoman's foot. Yeoman was the chap who had his foot blown off. Hear that Captain Scott had a bullet in his shoulder today, and altogether we had five casualties in the regiment today. So obviously it was fairly fierce stuff.
Was Scott one of the forward observers?
Yes, he was. That's right.
Mm. He was up with the infantry.
He was a troop commander, yes. That's right. They were the usual, they were the not only most often hit, but most often aimed at, because the obvious targets were the observation posts. And it's pretty obvious in many cases where they would be. And the next day, as expected, I've been told to replace Yeomans with the colonel at Tactical TAC HQ with the Infantry Brigade 167. Angus McCracken, well, I made some impolite comments. I found him a devil to be with, no sense of humour or proportion. In fact, he was a very worried and responsible man. Not young, obviously feeling enormously responsible. One of the few ex-territorials ever to command the Royal Artillery Regiment.
Do you think he'd been pushed beyond his limits?
No, I don't think so. It depends how relaxed you ought to be within your limits. He was dead serious and pretty morose within his limits, but he was performing. There was a later colonel, we will find, who may have been stretched or put beyond his limits. But that was a different kettle of fish. This man was of a lugubrious temperament. It was difficult for him to relax. I found myself by a railway embankment with a 7-ton white scout car trying to get to the colonel in his little caravan van headquarters. Getting stuck between these white scout cars were just totally inefficient vehicles, and they had four wheels, no tracks, and armour-plated sides, and they were just ultra-heavy, 7 tons on four wheels, and in the slightest bit of mud, they just slide into the side, and we got stuck, and it caused awful fuss, because the colonel didn't allow for mishaps of this kind. From his point of view, they were unacceptable.
So you were on your way up, and you got bogged because the vehicle was too heavy.
That's right. And we eventually got it out, but the colonel was cross about it, I understand. Our infantry, I've noted, London Scottish and Royal Fusiliers doing very well in the hills, and we can see the hillside of a place called Teano, T-E-A-N-O, occupied now by the London Scottish.
This half track, I mean, well,
there wasn't even a half track.
Wheeled vehicle. What was in it? Was it specially fitted out for your use in any way?
Yes, it had the wireless equipment in it, fixed radios fixed into places like a fitted kitchen, if you like.
Brackets, then?
Yes, that's right. I can't remember the detail, but it was rigged out. And the idea was obviously a protection of personnel riding in it, but it was just not a very sensible thing.
Presumably also it would mean protection of the radio set.
That's right, yes, that's right.
Could you make do without it? Was it possible to?
Well, they didn't. We had it, this particular vehicle, I think, saw through another few months. But in the later phases of the Italian campaign, I think we had rather better ones than this, things with half tracks. And the Germans, of course, are very strong on half tracks. We kept coming across burnt out half tracks. I can't remember whether the White Scout car was an American vehicle. I think it probably was. It was just ill thought. I mean, it was okay for the A1 or the M1, but it was absolutely useless for rutted tracks. I put, on arriving at the colonel after being stuck in this wadi of a road, nearly crushing the signaller against the wall, keeps sliding. The colonel is raving mad about delay and getting him the things he wants. Not surprisingly, since part of the misadventure was to break his whiskey in a ditch. to ruin his kit. So he wasn't a pleased man. Eventually, we arrived in a village called Fontanella with a wonderful view over a valley. We were obviously tending to be on rising ground at this time. And 2nd of November, we hear the Russians are now occupying the Crimea, sleep in a barn. The Germans left this farm 3 days ago. The Fusiliers are forging ahead. Here from home, they're not getting any letters through, so write again at once. Find myself sleeping on straw, reminiscent of gunner exercises in Northern Ireland. Wednesday, the 3rd of November, move position, Colonel crusty as usual. I'm becoming immune to his moods. The infantry are tearing ahead to the river Garigliano. Our guns are now out of range for firing at the enemy. Settle my regimental office in an Italian school. And we're surrounded by a lot of Basuto troops with mules.
Basuto, yes. From South Africa.
That's right. Booby traps all round. Have got books from home now.
What did the colonel do in order to? Well, you said he didn't relax much, but what did he do in his off-duty moments to occupy himself? Did he? You mentioned the whiskey, but presumably that couldn't have been an answer to everything.
No. He was not a drunkard, but he was a Scot, and he liked his Scotch. He was a very responsible-minded chap. I mean, he wouldn't. Waste time. He wouldn't be reading novels. He wouldn't even be reading his wife's plays. He would be consulting and talking to the battery commanders and the like. Whether he read the Bible, I really don't know. I doubt it. But I don't know what he did. The fact is that most times when one didn't have to be listening out for telephones and wireless sets, one tried to sleep.
Sounds as though he had an advanced case of Protestant work ethic.
I think this is probably true. He was a very serious-minded man. Of course, it was a serious business. I mean, somebody like, I've often reflected on somebody like Angus McCracken. I mean, he would have been too young to be in the First War, but he'd probably have joined the Territorials in the 1920s and have had a dozen years of exercises and preparation for war without knowing whether he'd ever be in one. And then suddenly he's a major then promoted colonel, obviously thought very highly of, and getting older, still physically fit, but not as fit as he was in his 20s. Concern, I should think, a feeling of huge responsibility. He was an admirable man. I mean, I don't want to, you know, detract from him. He was an admirable man. But it's not very easy to work for admirable men always, as I found in later life as a civil servant.
Is it easier to work for men who are not admirable?
It can be, it can be. Yes, they may relax more. However,
so you're closing up to the Garigliano, following up your infantry, but they got ahead of you, you were saying.
Yes, they're well ahead. And I've got a note here. You asked about something a few minutes ago, and I have a walk in the woods. First time I've been able to walk and reflect and relax out of touch with the enemy. A letter from home. It's the second I've received, but they say it's the eighth they've sent. So communications were a bit awkward. The brigade mess, I'm with the colonel at inter-brigade headquarters, is good. I speak to an Italian officer there. So, bingo, the Italians are beginning to come in a small way, positively.
Do you recall what you made of this Italian officer?
No, I have no recollection at all. It was the fact that the, you know, the dog can speak rather than what it said, which is remarkable. It was there at all because 2 months earlier he was our enemy.
Presumably he spoke to you in English, or were you
in Italian? We were, you know, we were getting a sort of lingua franca of, you know, bits of English, bits of Latin, of Italian by this time.
Pidgin Italian.
Which I still have, but it's never got beyond that stage. But he would be sent to our brigade headquarters, presumably, because he was an English speaker or reasonably competent. Otherwise, it would have been a waste of time.
He would presumably have been a liaison officer.
That's right. He was a liaison officer with the newly reforming Italian units, who presumably were paid by the Allies to reform and the like. Particularly the mountain regiments, Alpinieri and so on.
Well, I have a recollection that we organised, trained and armed the Italians, who produced something like five divisions, or
really?
Equivalents of divisions.
Yes.
And the Americans did the same with the French.
Uh-huh.
So the French had American equipment and training and command, and we got the Italians sorted out.
Hmm. That rather suggests there are a great many divisions. I don't remember as many as that, but...
I think that's what they generated throughout the whole the rest of the campaign.
Yes, yes.
Given the size of the Italian army, 8 million bayonets, I think Mussolini said.
Hmm.
3 milioni bayonetti.
Really, as many as that?
That's what he claimed. Not sure that he ever achieved it. I mean, five divisions would be...
But they were in no condition to pay for an army of their own. We must have been paying the lot, actually.
No, I mean, the war economy was in a very poor state,
that's
obviously.
That's right. Next day, move to a new position, open fields, establish office in a tent. The air is the most marvellous ever. We're now 3,000 feet up and the warm. Biting, bracingly cold at night, lovely days. We've now got some Americans in the brigade mess as well.
Where had they sprung from?
Well, we were in the American Fifth Army the whole of this time, you see.
Yes, but I mean, you seem to have been blissfully unaware of that fact until now.
Well, I had had one or two meals in the American mess in the Salerno Bridge.
Yes, American rations too.
And we've had the compo rations, but we were. It's true that. It would only be at divisional level that you would tend to meet Americans, or corps level.
They've been mentioning division.
We were 10 corps, we were,
Yes,
the 56th London Division. Yes.
I mean, had you had much occasion to go to divisional headquarters, apart from picking up
only once or twice I had been to these briefing sessions by the intelligence people. There was no real occasion to go to division headquarters.
I mean, did the divisional commander show himself down at brigade level? Remember seeing him or meeting him?
No, I didn't see him. I saw divisional commander, corps commander, and indeed General Alexander himself on the day that lad had his foot blown off. I remember them coming through on to have a look at things. Alexander, I remember particularly, because he was so distinguished a figure. But no, divisional commander comes along a little bit later when it was Templar, who was later an exceedingly distinguished man. Shall we go and...
What impression did you get of the American officers?
Well, I had very little to do with them, and so my impressions were minimal until rather later than this, when I was lucky enough to draw in a ballot for a four-day Christmas break in Sorrento. And this was an officer's leave hotel, but mainly American, since it was the American Fifth Army and the American divisions outnumbered ours. And there we mixed with the Americans for 3 or 4 days, found them at their, most outgoing, to put it mildly, dancing, getting drunk, and all the other things. And I don't know quite how to describe the experiences with them, but they were much less inhibited than we were. Three of us went out with a couple of Americans on the night of Boxing Day 1943 from this place in Sorrento, and in a jeep they haired round the precipitous coast of Positano and other villages, clinging to the cliff tops. And it was only because of strong disapproval that the landlady of a pub we went into, a wine bar, was not sexually assaulted by one of the American officers. They didn't seem to have the same inhibitions at all, or at least he didn't. And we had to virtually drag him away from this bar. But that's nothing to do with the Americans generally. We didn't have a lot to do with them. Our divisions, our corps, were self-contained. My main social memory of the Americans is the horror with which I saw them putting marmalade on their bacon at breakfast.
Now, I'd like to go back a bit further. Something I should have followed up. You mentioned earlier on about your first experience of being dive-bombed.
Yes.
Could you say a bit more about that, about what sort of aircraft were involved? And
I was never any good at aircraft recognition. Mm. It wasn't actually my first experience of being dive-bombed. The first experience had been during the Salerno landing, when we were heavily and closely dive-bombed and saw the bombs actually coming down and just missing the rails of the ship and landing in the water. That was a bit hairy. I don't know why I mentioned more recently this dive-bombing on the land, except that it must have been fairly ferocious. If you have never experienced dive-bombing, the really frightening part about it is that it takes place at sunset, and they come right out of the setting sun deliberately, so you can't see them, and all you can see is the bright Mediterranean sun and the most colossal noise, deliberately inflated by sirens, I believe, and the bombs then come seemingly out of nowhere. If one is on the theme of frightening noises, the Nebelwerfer I don't know whether you know of those, but they were the most terrifying things which we frequently encountered. I think there were sort of 9-barreled mortars with sirens deliberately attached to them, which made the most ghastly, weird and horrendous noise as they came down.
What about the air situation generally? Because we've been discussing fighting on the ground, and mentioned being attacked from the air by the Germans. Did you see? Was there very much action in the air?
No, very little. Very little. We, of course, had our air OPs from time to time, and there was some aerial reconnaissance. Because I've got aerial photographs as evidence of that. The air OPs we didn't use much, but on the flat ground of the kind you've been talking about, they were very useful and quite extraordinarily brave, hovering over the German positions at fairly low altitudes.
Did you ever go up in a
air
OP?
No, I didn't. No. Mm.
What level were they held at? Were they core troops or?
Certainly not. Well, I'm not sure they were army level. Yes, of course they were army. Yes, they were army. I would think corps at the very least, if not army level. They were not divisional.
Do you remember ever seeing any RAF liaison officers or forward air controllers in 56th Division or your brigade?
No, I didn't meet any RAF people at all throughout the Italian campaign.
Do you remember any occasion where you had or saw RAF delivering close air support?
Not close air support, no. We had close naval support by the Navy at Salerno. Mm. The Air Force, obviously, were doing some bombing at Salerno. The nearest I saw to air support of the kind which could hardly be described as close air support was when we were in the Anzio bridgehead somewhat later, and we saw 400 or 500 Flying Fortresses come over to bomb Cassino. That was in no sense air support, except in the most general strategic way, and it would have happened if there'd been no army there, or could have done.
So you were going forward up towards the Grigliano.
That's right. That's right. And I drove an American Jeep for the first time. We were beginning to be equipped with the Jeeps as opposed to our little utility Hillman trucks. narrow, precipitous roads round these. I did say there were some Americans in the brigade mess. I mentioned that, but I say no more about them. I visited, went in a jeep, visited one of our observation posts, and I said it was the best view I ever had in my life, with the Mediterranean sun and the background. I would like to come here again in peacetime. Can actually watch our shells landing on in the German territory. I've now been listed officially as assistant adjutant. Turns bitterly cold, etc.
Well, how was the weather doing at that stage? Because one has the impression that in the autumn and late autumn, Italy is drenched with heavy rain and creates a lot of mud. Did you find that?
Oh, it was absolutely frightful. We got mud-bound. I mentioned that scout car, which wouldn't negotiate the country lanes at all because of the slightest mud sent it slipping into the sides. There was a great deal of rain and mud, but this was a patch of good weather. November, October had been foul.
Did you find that your progress was impeded by demolitions on the part of the enemy? Had they?
Oh, they blew the bridges over the Volturno and, of course, the Grigliano and any other bridge they could find.
What about the roads? Did they crater the roads at all? Or
I don't think they had any need to. They were so abominable. and we were not on main roads, even if there were any. I suppose there were some good Mussolini-built roads, like the railways, down the west coast of Italy, but on the whole, we were on fairly narrow tracks. We come to the point on the 7th of November where I haven't mentioned the target, but the guards attacked and we supported with a barrage. The brigadier RA, that's the CRA, the one we were discussing, rings through to Colonel McCracken in his caravan, tells him he's been awarded the DSO.